Disclaimer: the views and opinions expressed by the participants in this show are not the views of AnimeNewsNetwork.com. Enjoy the show. I'm Zach Burchie. Joining me this week is Justin Savegas.
Howdy.
And our very special guest is the former senior vice president of Tokyo Pop. It's Mike Kiley. Mike, thank you so much for coming on and talking to us.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Hi, everybody out there.
Mike, you have been involved with anime and manga for as long as most of our readers have probably been
alive.
I wasn't going to go there, but... Originally, people first started to get to know you when you were at UCI Bookstore way back in the day. So, now, how did you get involved with anime from the earliest days that you started discovering it?
Well, there's a couple steps before the UCI experience. When I was a little kid, and we're really talking about late 60s probably, I watched a couple of shows, and they were on public access television in the LA area. One of them was Gigantor, and one of them was Tobor the Ape Men. And I just thought they were so incredibly weird and bizarre, and they were obviously from a different place, very different from anything else you could see on TV at the time. And so I dug them. I didn't really pursue that interest for a while. Then I got into high school, and my best friend in high school was from a Japanese-American family. And he turned me on to Japan as a whole. He turned me on to Mishima and Kawabata and Ozu and Kurosawa and all these guys that have really become a significant part of my sort of artistic and intellectual experience, you know. And so I'd always had this affinity for Japan. Flash forward to the early 90s at UCI. I had been there for a long time and was getting, you know, a little restless. And then this thing called the internet came along, and this was actually slightly before the first Mosaic browser was even out. We put together an online bookstore at UCI, which sold medical and technical books to customers around the world before Amazon.
Right.
I was also interested in stocking a newsstand in the store, and so I set up an account with, at the time, a competitor of Diamond Comics called Capital City.
And they started, rest in peace.
Yeah, they were a great company. And I started bringing in, not really knowing anything about anime and manga, but, you know, having this kind of affinity for Japan, started bringing in some things, and two strange things happened. First of all, UCI, and it continues to this day, is predominantly Asian. And
right.
So there was a population there that flocked to this stuff. The other thing was I had the harebrained idea of putting these things up online. As part of our, you know, medical and technical, how natural is that? You know, makes sense. And so that became the foundation of what eventually, by 1998, became a $1 million a year gray market import anime and manga business. It started with some little comic books. I then took some, I got into Japanese language classes at night, got to the point where I could read catalogs, found a supplier in Tokyo, brought in laser discs and compact discs and stuffed Totoros, and continued to develop this mailing list to the point where it was a significant business. And I ran that through late 98, which is when I moved over and Mix Entertainment, which Stu Levy had founded a couple years before that, morphed into Tokyo Pop when I joined.
I see. It sounds almost like you discovered the market, almost stumbled on it by accident.
I think that's a fair statement to make. Yeah, I'm basically a pretty impulsive, kind of an instinctive guy. I loved the material. I mean, this was, you know, mid to late 90s. There were two things that I thought were really, really cool about anime. First of all, it was the content itself. It was the attachment to Japan. It was, you know, it was cyberpunk. It was a different way of storytelling. It was graphically really, really, really interesting. And the other thing about it, and this is something that your listeners today probably find it very hard to believe, is that it was really, really hard to get. And so it was a collector's kind of acquisitive underground kind of thing. It wasn't in Borders and Barnes & Noble and Best Buy and Suncoast Video. you had to really seek it out. And I, you know, I'm kind of an indie punk rock kind of guy anyway, and I responded to that. I thought that was really, really cool. You know, you throw all that and then add the internet into the mix and a newsletter that I was able to write every week and communicate with people and take pre-orders and say, hey, Dreams Come True has a new record coming out. It was just really, really kind of intoxicating. But to say there was any kind of master plan or I identified a market and then met a need, I think is really, you know, would be silly, because it just kind of, I had no idea it was going to go where it went. It was just fun. Yeah.
Dreams Come True is not really punk rock, but I just want to so that's awesome. So,
But I Want to Be Your Dog is, which was what was playing when you guys walked in.
Okay,
so
fair enough.
You got to give me some props for that.
Fair enough. So how did you meet Stu Levy, and how did that whole connection with Mix start?
It started, I mentioned that I had taken Japanese and I put this website online. The LA Times did a profile of me in either late 96 or early 97, which Stu read. Stu was this crazy gaijin running around in Japan trying to do, you know, whatever he was eventually going to do.
Yeah, sorry.
And he read the article in the paper and came down to Irvine, and we met a couple of times. And it was probably, I guess it probably was early 97 when I first met him. And then I think I was simply at the point where I'd kind of done what I could do at UCI, and it was a very sort of, you know, there were people like, I think there was a company at the time called Nikkaku Animart, who were really, you know, a good, you know, sort of competitor, if you will, for imported stuff. And they were squawking about, you know, how is a university in this business, and is that really fair? And, you know, totally valid points. It was a ridiculous thing for me to be doing at a public institution.
Right.
It was just, you know, fun, and I was, you know, able to do it. So I decided to, you know, to take a chance and leave a very secure kind of, you know, upper middle class permanent gig with the University of California, and go into business, you know, with Stu.
Initially, you were in charge of a web initiative there, mm-hmm. weren't you?
Yeah, basically, I took the online e-commerce component that I built at UCI, and a lot of those people came over with me, thankfully, to what became Tokyopop, and it was a pure e-commerce play. I wouldn't have gone over just for e-commerce because, you know, that wasn't really interesting in the long term for me.
Yeah.
But what we called it back in the day was commerce, content, and community, the three C's. And, you know, I mean, there are variations of that all the way up until today, that that's really what we were trying to achieve, is the ability to become, you know, an informational source, a community resource for people interested in that kind of material, and a purveyor of hard-to-find goods.
I see. So when you first walked in the door, that era at... I can't remember. I don't remember if they were Mix yet or Tokyopop.
We became Tokyopop the day that I launched. Essentially, my first day, if you will, was the launch of Tokyopop.com.
I see. And where was Mix at a company as a company at that point? Because they
where
had
were
launched
they physically.
Well, no. I mean, they had launched two magazines.
They had just launched. My recollection, and you know, you can obviously, you know, verify all these things, but
right.
My recollection is they had just launched Smile,
right,
which was the second of the two magazines,
right. They
Mix being the first.
They were, you know, there were a little bit of controversy at that time.
Oh yeah,
time.
Yeah.
What were your impressions of the place, your coworkers, what the task before you?
Well, to be honest, those first few years that I was with the company, my coworkers were essentially me and this guy named Tui Dang, who is a good buddy of mine from the UCI days, in a warehouse in Tustin. Because, you know, I wasn't going to go up to, you know, I had my kids were fairly young. I wasn't going to commute. I lived in Irvine. And so the deal I made was to run this e-commerce initiative out of Orange County. So, you know, as it grew, there were other people that came on board, but it wasn't until 2002 that I became kind of in the thick of things up in LA. So my first few years were pretty much me just kind of doing continuation of what I'd done at UCI on a slightly larger scale.
So what happened to that e-commerce venture?
Basically, we folded it up after about 4 years. And it was, you know, I mean, there were like anything, there were successes and failures. I think that the product base was probably expanded beyond what really needed to be. We were trying to become a little bit more Asian pop culture generally, rather than just hardcore Japanese imported stuff. But it just sort of ran its course.
I see. Tell us a little bit about moving into the proper Tokyopop headquarters after that.
Mm-hmm. Well, the first thing I did was, just to give you an idea of what I did in the entirety of my Tokyopop experience, those e-commerce years, the years we just discussed, through about 2002, then there was a period of time for about another 2 years through 2004 when I was primarily the web guy at Tokyopop. Working on various iterations of the Tokyopop.com website.
Right.
And then from 2004 through 2008, I was the editor-in-chief and subsequently publisher, in charge of all the manga business. And then from 2008 until the time I left, I was senior VP in charge of trying to monetize some of these properties developed in other media. So the period you're talking about, the first period up there, was basically the Tokyopop.com, the early Tokyopop.com years.
Right.
And it was, it was exciting. It was a growing company. When I first got up there, I think there were probably, maybe 30, 35 employees, something like that. Basically, what had just happened at that point was Stu's decision, which was the best decision he ever made, but certainly one of the better decisions he ever made, which was to standardize the format, to go right to left, to go digest, to go 9.99, and coupled with all that, to radically change and expand sales and distribution, so that we got out of the sort of direct market and into the mall bookstores, which is what was primarily responsible for the explosion of manga in the early aughts, I guess that decade is called. So that was just happening when I came up to LA and started working on Tokyopop.com.
I remember seeing at the time the list of monthly SKUs balloon from you guys from like 3 to like 30.
Yeah, I don't think it was quite that dramatic, but it was very dramatic.
Yeah, I remember we were just looking at it at CPM and marveling. It's like, how are they going to do this? They're going to kill themselves.
Right, right. Well, we did it by expanding very, very quickly.
Just hired a lot of people?
We hired people as we went. I mean, we eventually grew to, from that 30 or 35 up into, I don't know that we ever cracked triple digits in LA, but probably in the 90 range, something like that.
Plus freelancers, I'm sure.
Sure, absolutely. It wasn't like flipping a switch, but there was definitely a feeling that more. The floodgates had opened. We had a formula. We had an ability to deliver to secure the content, to deliver it in an efficient way, and to sell it. And so we were riding the crest of that wave.
So that time where Stu made that fairly momentous decision to basically change the manga industry and blow it up, there was a period there, a couple of years, where you guys were doing just imported titles. You were bringing stuff over from Japan. It seemed like there was a very stark moment, maybe 2004-ish, maybe 2005, maybe earlier than that, where it seemed like the strategy shifted over into like the whole Rising Stars of Manga thing.
Yeah,
we haven't gotten to that yet, but yeah. I guess once we get there, maybe I'm jumping the gun on this a little bit, how you felt about that shift. But maybe we'll get to that in a bit.
Yeah, that's kind of the next phase of the history.
Okay, well, let's stay with this phase for now.
Just so everyone remembers what we're talking, for those of you who can remember those years, they were kicked off by a little girl named Sailor Moon. And they were really, I really think of those as like the peak Kodansha years. Mm. We had a very, very special relationship with Kodansha, and there were titles like Cardcaptor Sakura and Chobits and Love Hina, which were hugely popular, and underpinned by Sailor Moon, which was really, and Sailor Moon was the license that was essentially responsible for Tokyopop Mix before it even existed.
So you had a couple really huge sellers, and you were making the book scan, top lists on a regular basis, which had never really been done in manga before.
Mm-hmm.
What was the atmosphere like? What was What was that like being?
It was it was a very heady atmosphere. It was very exciting. It was very everybody knew we had a tiger by the tail. We were expanding, as I mentioned before. I don't know whether there will ever, you know, in the course of our discussion today, become an opportunity for Mike. What did you like best about Tokyo Pop? But I'll interject here that the thing that I found coming from the university environment, where I was very used to being around college age students who were, you know, I mean, when they weren't smoking dope, they were really fun to be around. They were inquisitive. They were interesting. They kept you honest and on your toes. Tokyo Pop was that on steroids. I mean, we had such an amazing group of people come through those doors. And for me personally, even with all of the professional and intellectual and artistic fulfillment I got in different phases of my career there, nothing topped the exposure to the cavalcade of characters that came through our doors. So that was really, really fun.
Anybody in particular stand out?
You know what? I'm kind of in a position where if I were to start mentioning individual people, you know, it's sort of I actually wrote a little bit of a tribute to some of my coworkers that is on it's online somewhere, and I'll show you where that is because
you can send us a link. We'll be happy to link it.
Yeah. But just. Fantastically talented, crazy, whacked out, you know, people to be around. It was great.
Okay. So what happened next?
So what happened next was, you know, in another act of, I think, a certain amount of corporate prescience, you know, getting to your question earlier, Zach, we understood that we were going to have a problem in the long run, and that problem was going to be access to content. That basically, you know, I mentioned the floodgates opening. Let me kind of describe a little bit what I mean by that. My personal philosophy is that there's no harder thing in the world in entertainment to do than to create a hit. That is the single hardest thing to do. It turns out that the Japanese aren't any better at that than anybody else. And so the illusion that you had in the mid-aughts during this gold rush floodgate kind of period is that, oh my God, the content from Japan is incredible. Look at this stuff. Well, what no one really realized, well, I shouldn't say no one, because people who knew Japan knew this, is that that content that was being released at that time had been developed for 10 or 12 or 15 or 18 or 20 years. And there had been this pent-up demand that companies like Tokyo Pop were just beginning to tap into, and there was a finite supply of it.
So in the space of 3 years, we got the best of the last 20.
Exactly. Yeah. And so when you get to the point, you know, later in the aughts where you're kind of like day and date, you know, as they like to say, it's like, okay, Japan, what do you got? Well, you know, the challenge we were going to have is that there were a limited number of places we could license from, you know, as sort of alliances changed. Our chief competitor was a wholly owned subsidiary of the two largest manga publishers in Japan.
And so
that was locked out. There was a major event, I think in 03 or 04, in terms of a worldwide publishing alliance between Kodansha and Random House, which then spawned the Del Rey manga imprint because they were part of Random House, which gave them, you know, the sort of inside track for all of the Kodansha licenses, which had been such an important part of our mix. And so, you know, we saw all this happening, and we're like, you know, holy shit, what are we going to do? You know, because it's not going to last forever kind of thing. And that led us to the conclusion that maybe we should try to develop some of our own content, that maybe that would be a way to sort of hedge our bets, to really become a full-fledged entertainment studio, and to actually own some IP. Kind of concurrent with that was there were other things happening peripherally. We were getting into what we call brand licensed manga, you know, alliances with Disney and Blizzard and companies like this. And also, there were several years during that period when the Cinemanga business was huge. Mm-hmm. You know,
Cinemanga being the manga made from screen capture.
Yeah, the Kim Possible, you know, Lizzie McGuire kinds of things. That was a major initiative. There was, you know, there were half a dozen really, really good people working on that.
Yeah, I remember being aggressively sold on, why don't you guys cover NBA Cinemanga? We really want you to do an article on NBA Cinemanga. I'm like, dude, our readers do not care about NBA Cinemanga. And they're like, right, right. But it's manga. It's like, no, dude.
Yeah, the first one of those, I think, was Shaq, the Shaquille O'Neal book. And that book's claim to fame was it literally had at its back a fold-out of a life-size Shaquille O'Neal shoe, which made it very, very popular in its day.
So. I'm sure. I can only imagine the Scholastic book sale numbers.
Absolutely.
Just to go back a little bit, Kodansha, obviously they were such an important partner for you guys. What was the process of them pulling back to invest in distribution elsewhere? Was that just like a switch that turned off one day? It's like, we're not going to license to you anymore?
Well, no, it wasn't like that at all. It was simply that at the highest sort of international levels, to say nothing of Kodansha manga, there had been this agreement struck between Japan and, well, not even between Japan and the U.S., between Kodansha and Random House.
Right.
And so, yeah, it just became, we continued to do business with them, continued to even get new licenses from them occasionally, but it was simply the fact that we clearly weren't their strategic partner.
I see.
Their sort of go-to publisher.
So it just kind of got harder and harder, and the titles got more and more picked over.
Yes.
Got it.
Yeah.
So that brings us to Rising Stars of Manga.
Yeah, so we were looking at, you know, a number of things to kind of diversify. We're looking at novels. We got into a novels line. So yeah, the Rising Stars, basically we were, you know, just kind of brainstorming a way to get into the business of creating manga ourselves. You know, not localizing, not translating, localizing, and distributing, but actually making manga ourselves. And the Rising Stars of Manga was, we thought, you know, a reasonable way to be kind of, you know, sort of fan-centric in the sense that we would reach out in the form of a contest, solicit entries, evaluate those entries, and use some of that material, potentially, if it were good enough, as springboards into, you know, ongoing series. Mm-hmm. So that, I believe, began around the 2004 period of time.
Right. How did initially they were anthologies, mm-hmm. That you published. How did those? I always looked through those and wondered if they sold.
How did they do commercially?
Yes.
The actual graphic novels themselves.
Yes.
I think the first one or two did okay, and yeah, you know, I mean, anthologies. I don't know. I think the industry in general doesn't do fabulous with anthologies, and we were certainly no exception to that rule.
From there, you guys obviously went off and did, obviously, dedicated novels of the more popular winners, I guess.
Yes, yeah, and that kind of takes us into the hardcore, what became popularly known and sometimes pejoratively known as OEL.
Right.
And that was the books and the properties that went into the OEL program were only partly a function of the Rising Stars process. Sometimes they were. In the early days, many, many times they were. But other times we would just, you know, we'd want to work with someone, so we'd reach out to them. They'd reach out to us. You know, word quickly spread. There wasn't anybody doing what we were doing.
Right.
You know, we were consciously trying to develop original comics in a manga sort of idiom. And I used to do just, you know, interviews ad nauseum with all kinds of places back in those days. And, you know, the party line, and it was something that I really truly believed in, is that, you know, manga is this thing like jazz. You know, jazz was born in New Orleans, but every place else on Earth, most other places on Earth, have their own sort of local flavors of jazz. It doesn't mean they're any better or worse than authentic jazz. It just takes a different form. And so that was our sort of approach with manga is but yeah, there could be Spanish. There is Spanish manga. There's French manga. There's Amera manga. And Amera manga, of course, preceded Tokyo Pop, and some of it is just on a smaller scale.
Right.
Yeah, you guys spent a lot of time trying to rebrand that as the word you guys came up with. Wasn't it World Manga for a little bit, and then it turned into OEL?
No, I'm glad you brought that up. We never branded anything except for manga.
Okay.
Now, that actually, in my humble opinion, probably ended up coming back to bite us in the ass a little bit years later. Because the fact of the matter is, it was an uphill battle. It was an uphill battle. I mean, you, as much as we wanted to, it was going to be very, very difficult to call, you know, everything from Fruits Basket to Demon Diary to Brandon Graham's King City to Becky Cloonan's East Coast Rising manga. You know, I mean, we understood it intellectually, how to make that case, but
manga already meant Japanese comics.
It wasn't going to fly.
Yeah.
You know, and And, you know, we're kind of bouncing all over the map here a little bit, but I think in retrospect, that was certainly a mistake to try that. You know, we tried a whole bunch of shit that didn't work. That was one of them. And I think also I'd also feel comfortable in saying that I don't think we did certain kinds of books in the OEL program any favors by including them under that rubric, because there was material there that just, it needed to be in a different form. It needed to be not solely black and white, or not solely $9.99, or sold to 14-year-old girls that were buying, you know, Sailor Moon. We were fortunate enough to work with a variety of writers and artists, only some of whom could realistically, in retrospect, have been expected to appeal to that core audience. Others, you know, we should have taken a different approach. And we shouldn't have tried to sort of pigeonhole them into this sort of banner of manga, in my opinion.
Were there any particular titles that you feel were either damaged by the format, or, like, you looked at this and you said, I don't understand why this isn't hitting, because it really seems like a hit?
Well, I think two that I mentioned already, King City and East Coast Rising, would definitely fall into that category.
Right.
I mean, I don't know if you guys know the Becky's and Brandon's work.
I've read the latter, yeah.
But they're just amazingly talented people, and they probably would have been better served in a different format, with a different sort of, you know... I mean, we haven't even gotten into marketing and audience and demographics and all of those things, but I think simply from a physical point of view, yeah, they could have perhaps been better presented in a different way. Now, all that being said, the fact of the matter is, we were always extremely upfront with everybody in terms of, you know, the deals that we signed, the contracts that we did. We had just one of my favorite guys in the history of Tokyo Pop was our general counsel, this guy named Bill Josie. And Bill was such a super dude in terms of talking to every single one of these creators that we did a deal with and articulating very, very precisely what our approach was and these kinds of things. And so it's very, very difficult for me to believe that anyone could even begin to make a case that, oh, I didn't understand what I was getting into, or blah, 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 because of the yeoman work that people like Bill did. But at the same time, you know, that's what hindsight is for. You know, you look back and it wasn't always necessarily the best match.
Right. There's a whole new skill here that you kind of leveled up on that we kind of glossed over, which was suddenly you're managing creative artists,
mm-hmm.
Many of whom had never had a professional gig before.
Right.
What was that like? What were some of the pitfalls and weirdness? I'm sure you have some stories there.
Well, I mean, it was. We worked with a very, very broad spectrum of artists and writers, and some of them, you're right, it was their absolute first gig. You know, they've been drawing for 8 or 10 years and praised throughout all their art classes through high school and college, and this was their first professional gig. And like a lot of things at Tokyo Pop, we were victims of our own sort of, you know, aggressiveness and just sort of pedal to the metal kind of mentality. And we probably in those days, it's very safe to say, we published too much, you know. At the same time, I think we gave incredible opportunities to people who otherwise would not have had, you know, anything close to that level of distribution into major retail outlets, and the ability to work with a top-notch professional editorial staff. And a lot of them have gone on to you know, different things. You know, whether they're bigger and better, who knows? But it was their first job, and they got started. But yeah, some of them, you know, deadline. It was the whole thing of when you're a licensed manga company, you can be very, very precise. I mean, there are certain things that can't be predicted, like how long a licensor will take to approve something, or whether this cover is going to come back, you know, in the proper form, whether we have the right files, whether our freelance translator got meningitis and isn't going to turn in. But in general, it can be, that business can be systematized.
You're working with something that already exists.
Exactly. When you're creating it, it's, of course, an entirely different ballgame, and deadlines are blown. Hands need to be held, you know, midnight phone calls need to be made. Sales and marketing will scream at editorial and production because their books aren't ready and they need to be rescheduled. And so there was a lot of, all of those things were part of our growing pains in you know, learning how to bring great content to market with a wide variety of creators.
During this period, were you expanding the staff to handle these new responsibilities?
Oh,
okay, so you weren't just like putting, making people wear different hats.
No. And we, you know, we had a number of different, as the OEL program got larger, there were people who were specifically focused on these kinds of development questions because it's a totally different skill set than the acquisitions process. The acquisitions process needs people who are fluent in Japanese or Korean, who can evaluate existing material and map that content onto market opportunities in our market. And that's a very, very rare and important skill, but it's completely different from someone, from an editor who can work with a writer to create a compelling story, or work with an artist to tighten up his thumbnails in order to bring something to fruition. So yeah, there were definitely, we kind of evolved into different sort of departments, if you will, sub-departments.
So, but before we move on from OEL, one of the big the flagship for all of this was Princess I, and I'm curious. What was your take on that? What was your experience? Did you ever get close to working on that project yourself? Or what was that like? Because it was a huge undertaking for you guys.
Yeah, it was. And no, I never... The only involvement, direct involvement that I had with Princess Eye over the years is basically on the script side, that I would look at scripts and
okay.
you know, give feedback and try to shape them where I could. But that, of course, was a Studio TV production.
Yep.
And...
Specifically DJ Milky.
In the early days, yes. Yeah. And I don't know that I would necessarily describe it. The significant thing about Princess Eye was that from a purely visual, graphical point of view, it probably looked more like manga than anything else in the OEL program at the time, even though we eventually in OEL started working with more Japanese artists. That was Kujirado-san was Japanese, and she was very talented, and you know, we had character designs by a very famous Japanese mangaka as well, and so it had that sort of, you know, pedigree. Now, it also was written by a guy who, for better or worse, had you know, quite a history in fandom, and quite a rep, if you will, but I think purely by the nature of its pedigree, it was going to be something that we put a lot of energy into, which we obviously did. Whether it really became the flagship of the program, I'm not really sure. It was certainly one of our better selling titles. Did it outsell Bizengas? Did it outsell DramaCon? Was it more popular than either of those two? I kind of see those as sort of the triumvirate of the program.
Okay.
But because of Stu's involvement, yeah, it had a very, very high profile.
And maybe we could put these rumors to rest. There's a lot of chatter back and forth. How much involvement did Courtney Love actually have?
Well, I don't know that I'm the best person to comment on that because I was never in the room, you know,
okay.
with Stu and Courtney doing their thing. My impression, having gathered, you know, in various conversations with Stu over the years, is that the core of it is essentially Courtney's story. Hmm. That basically Courtney had a very similar kind, you know, she wasn't a supernatural princess, but she did go to Tokyo at a very young age, and she was an entertainer, and she had these thoughts about her experiences in Japan, and they were very important to her, and she and Stu kind of got together and just banged out the skeleton.
Yeah, there's people chitter chat about how, you know, there was one phone call and that was it. She just put her name on it or whatever.
I think it was significantly more than that.
Okay.
Okay.
I never saw Courtney deliver a script.
Okay.
But I do know that she was much more involved in it.
Fair enough. So around this time also, you guys lived for a few years anime division. Were you involved mm-hmm. with that?
Not really. That was actually during the time when I was kind of the TokyoPop.com dude.
So that was earlier.
2001, maybe 2000 through 2003, something like that. And yeah, I mean, they did some great stuff. I mean, I don't know that it was ever super, super popular in terms of it being the engine that, that sort of drove things in those days. But there were some really strong titles. I mean, Marmalade Boy was a Tokyopop anime title.
I still have the bricks.
You know, GTO, Initial D, which is, as you guys may know, had a very kind of checkered past.
Yes.
But yeah, there were it was a significant part of the company. I think it became just something that we weren't able to focus. It's very expensive, and by the time we were in a financial position to maybe ramp it up, you already saw the beginnings of the end, you know, at retail for anime. And so it was something that we never just exploded.
So you guys just were like, yeah, this isn't working out. Let's just let's call up Funimation and see if they're interested, basically.
Yeah, I mean, I think, again, there was kind of a moment there when we needed to decide whether to invest further. Mm-hmm. And we saw what was happening to the market. You know,
yeah.
It wasn't a great time for anime at retail.
During these, we're still talking about what are ostensibly the boom years of manga.
Mm-hmm.
What was the day-to-day like working with the bookstores? Did they get it? Did they pretend to get it because it was selling? How did that?
Well, that's a tough question to answer. And I have very, very pointed feelings about the inefficiencies baked into the book retail system, the publisher bookseller sort of relationship. It's a very inefficient way to move product. Books, as you may or may not know, are fully returnable, and so they're basically put into stores on consignment, and if they sell, everybody's happy, and if they don't sell, the bookseller returns them to the publisher for credit.
Just like video.
Well, video, it depends on the retailer.
Right.
I think the video business and the CD business were a little bit more restrictive in terms of returns, but in the book business, you basically can return anything you buy. Anything you buy, with air quotes around.
Right.
And so, you know, I mean, I think it's how much... We had an extremely fantastic relationship with HarperCollins. You know, I love those guys. You know, we had a very successful co-publishing program with them, where we did manga based on some of their properties like Warriors, and they were a lot of fun to work with. I think they over time, their sales force understood manga and what the opportunity was. Did any of them ever flip and become otaku? There were a couple of Harper people who would show up at San Diego Comic-Con every year and cosplay. So Tokyopop was responsible for that degree of degradation of a sanctified New York publishing house.
Oh, dear God.
But at the same time, you know, it's clearly a business that is under siege. You know, I mean, where is it? You can talk all you want about print versus digital and what's going to happen there ultimately. I think we all know. But even the print that will continue to exist in whatever form it exists, it's just not both parties don't have the same amount of skin in the game.
Right.
You know, you mentioned the boom years, and yeah, they were boom years. But one of the other things you have to understand about book publishing is, and we could have done a better job in this regard, is you have to understand what's actually going through the cash register even more than you understand what's being put into the stores. Because what's being put into the stores is a function of, you know, the persuasiveness of your salespeople and the receptivity of the individual buyer. And it's a very, even though there are spreadsheets on each side of the table and they're looking at numbers and they're looking at what to fill in, you've got things you're trying to push for various reasons. They've got initiatives they're trying to push. But at the end of the day, all of that is bullshit until someone picks the book off their shelf and puts $10 down at the cash register. That's the thing that really needs to govern more than it does what happens in publishing.
Did you guys ever get direct sales numbers?
So you weren't
reliant on BookScan or anything like that to know how you did?
No. We got really good data from once we hooked up with HarperCollins, which was in 2006. We got very, very good data in that regard.
Did that relationship as the book retail market started really spiraling the drain in the last 5 years or so, did that relationship become more and more strained over time, would you say?
Um, Well, I mean, everybody saw where it was going, and so yeah, I mean, there were you know, why is this happening? You know, when we had to do our sort of you know, June purge in 2008, when we let go so many people, you know, in that mass layoff, that was a result of, you know, just a year of getting hammered mercilessly with returns. And so a lot of those returns were product that we put out there during the boom years that began to come back, that hadn't sold, what we call sold through at retail.
How long had some of that stuff been there?
Oh, in some cases, you know, we would get material back that had been there 4, 5, 6, 7 years.
I imagine shop worn, there's no way you could sell it again.
Most of the stuff that comes back that's that old is unsaleable, yes.
I guess it's been read by 1,500 teenagers.
Has pizza stains on every page.
The squads of girls lying in the aisles.
I don't miss those days.
No.
But I think it's important to know that, as frustrated as I may be coming across in terms of the inefficiencies of the retail model, it is a two-way street, in all fairness to booksellers. Publishers need to be extremely disciplined about what they put in. Publishers need to say, you know what, there's no way you should be taking, you know, 4,800 copies of Demon Diary. You know, we look at what the first four volumes did. We know that you love the series, but, you know, let's try 2,000 and see how it goes.
Or 6 months from now, I'm going to be buried in returns and die.
And but everybody's trying to make their numbers. Everybody's running around trying to grow as fast as they can. And so, you know, it's not always everybody's getting pressure from above in terms of making those numbers. It's not always you've got to be extremely rigorous and disciplined to sort of withstand a lot of those pressures. And it's not just the fault of the booksellers, certainly.
During this period, the notion among wonks like us and fans was that you had so much competition at this point. You had so many other publishers in the game. The market was flooded. The booksellers were going down the drain. The big sort of thing everyone always said about Tokyopop during those years was, well, they have Fruits Basket, and that's what's keeping the doors open and the lights on. Is there any truth to that? Did you have other properties that were really keeping the company alive, or was it really Fruits Basket was pretty much keeping food on the table?
Well, I mean, every entertainment company is kept alive by its hits.
Right.
I mean,
right.
There's no secret in that. You know, there's the old 80-20 rule in just about any business, that 80% of your sales are from 20% of your products. Fruits Basket and Sailor Moon are the bookends of the Tokyopop experience. Mm. Sailor Moon at the beginning, Fruits Basket at the end. And when Fruits Basket ended, that was a significant blow. During the Fruits Basket years, yeah, there were lots of other titles. There was Sayuki, there was Loveless, there was DN Angel. I mean, these were big, big titles. But Fruits Basket was the 800-pound gorilla, and it was without a doubt the single most important title in the second half of the company's history.
What constituted a hit then? What kind of numbers would something have to do?
You know, again, you could probably get it from BookScan. I think Fruits Basket was probably selling certainly six figures per volume, maybe as many as 150,000 copies per volume.
Good.
I mean, the other big title at the time, which eventually ended up far superseding Fruits Basket, purely because of numbers of volumes, was Naruto. And those the numbers on those two titles were, I mean, the, you just don't see them anymore.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, I think Naruto at its peak was selling like almost 500,000 units per book.
I don't know if that's the case, but
at least 300,000. That's the number I saw.
It was hundreds of thousands, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. So when you were starting to see that a lot of stuff just wasn't moving, like a lot of the manhwa, the Korean licenses, and around, I think it was 06, was around the first time we really saw you guys just starting to pull back a little bit. I think a handful of series you were like, well, we might take this online only.
Mm-hmm.
How did that work? How low did the numbers have to be for you to consider that such a thing? And did that actually happen? I wasn't really paying attention.
Did what actually happen?
Did they see online only release, or did they just end up completely canceled?
I think in more often than not, those series ended up not seeing the light of day. And one of the major reasons for that is because this, we're talking 5 years ago now, so this is ancient history in the digital realm. Japanese and really all publishers at that time were, I mean, the internet and digital was just, it was anathema to them. They were panic stricken by it. And yeah. So, you know, whether that was ever a truly realistic option to continue a series, a licensed series online, from the point of view of the licensor, not really sure. Certainly not at that time. Mm. You know, and how would we have monetized it, you know, to begin with? We were trying to build up, you know, community of people, but those problems really haven't even been solved today.
So it was more just an idea that was floated.
Yeah, and you know, I'd have to go back over and really kind of refresh my memory about the particulars of that. I know there were things that we did try online only. I don't recall anything significant, and I don't recall any particular success stories in that regard.
You guys were usually pretty good at finishing what you started, even if sales weren't good.
Yeah.
How bad did a series have to tank in order to consider canceling it, and how weighty was that decision in your
meetings?
Well,
I don't know that there was ever a particular... I mean, there were certainly numbers that if you, you know... The scale of the business was larger then, so if something was selling fewer than 5,000 copies back then, you know, at the peak, it was a tragedy. By the end, when the market was much smaller, if it was selling less than 2,000 copies, it was a big deal. The decision to not continue something is probably the hardest decision you have to face, you know, as a publisher. I don't know how hard it is at a different kind of publisher, but at Tokyopop, or at any manga publisher, any niche publisher, you know, it's all about how the fans are going to react to that. I mean, the fact of the matter is, you could be selling 100 copies of something, and you can cancel it, and those 100 people are going to be really, really either sad, disappointed, upset, lynch mob like. You know,
we see all of those,
and they'll make sure that you know about that.
Yeah, and it's just, you know, you can't. It's really, really a drag. You know, there's no. I mean, you can come up with all kinds of, you know, bullshit kind of, you know, excuses or explanations at the time. But the fact of the matter is, if you're some kid in Topeka, Kansas, and you can't finish a series that you have been living for, you're going to be upset, you know. And it, you know, our industry is so naive and so earnest and so lovable and so endearing in so many ways. But it isn't always necessarily... a community that is characterized by its astute business sense. I mean, these kinds of things happen all the time in other businesses, and nobody really bats an eye necessarily. But we understand. But I'm not using that as an excuse, because when you go into business to service this community, you understand what you're signing up for. You're not selling widgets to, you know, Walmart. You're selling dreams. You're selling stories.
You're selling the only thing that's making your crappy teenage years livable.
Exactly. You know, and there's a certain responsibility that comes with that. And when you break that covenant, if you will, not to use, you know, language that's too highfalutin, but in a sense, that's how fans think of the people that bring them, you know, things like Petalia. You know, I mean, it's just. It's what happens, you know. And there's no elegant way out of it. You know?
Yeah.
If there is, you know, let me know.
Oh, we haven't found one. Pretty sure you're right.
During that particular period where you're sort of on the decline at this point, were there any decisions then that you wish you had made, or decisions you wish you hadn't made, or that the company hadn't made? Were there any big mistakes in there that you could point to and say, you know, if we'd have done that differently, mm-hmm. things would have lasted longer?
You know, I think that the probably the criticism that can be leveled against Tokyopop almost without fail at a number of different sort of junctures of its history, we always tried to do too much. You know, we were aggressive, ambitious, we were looking to scale, we were looking to get large, we were looking to take this little thing that we all loved because it came from a country that we'd all fallen in love with, and really blow it out in a way that could truly, you know, be impressive. And so the decisions that you make when you're trying to do that, in retrospect, there was a different path, and a different path would have been for more focus, more discipline, smaller scale, But it wouldn't have been Tokyo Pop. I mean, the fact of the matter is that word connotes a lot of things. And what we accomplished in a fairly short period of time was fairly momentous. And we wouldn't have done those things if we hadn't been who we were in terms of our corporate DNA. Now, it also could have been, you could also certainly make the argument that that was one of the major reasons for our downfall. And I own up to that, certainly. You know, it's... Could we have still been around today if we were publishing, you know, 8 or 10 things from Kintosha and Katakawa and four people in a cubbyhole on Wilshire? Yeah, maybe. But why? You know, it's not what that group of people coming together for that period of time was trying to do.
Yeah. Well, okay. On that point, though, I mean, I think what you just said, like a cubbyhole on Wilshire, people publishing 10, 15 titles, I think a lot of the people that got laid off would have thought that would be a pretty sweet gig at this point, like right now, which maybe, well, hey, maybe you should have focused on your core business and not have expanded into all these crazy areas. We'd still have jobs. Like, I think that would probably be the response you might get.
Well, I think a lot of people in a lot of businesses over the past 3 years would like to have their jobs back.
Yeah, well, that's true.
The matter is, the world has changed, and it's a very different place. And this was a private business run by a very aggressive, intense entrepreneur who had his own, you know, goals and ambitions. And no one had to sign up to work at Tokyo Pop or even buy Tokyo Pop's products. You know, it was what it was, and it was very exciting and ridiculous and infuriating and interesting. And at the end of the day, it failed. And it ran as a business for 15 years, which is certainly longer than most small businesses survive. And it had some spectacular successes along the way. I'm not trying to sound callous about people, especially who worked for Tokyo Pop, who lost their jobs, because that was the single worst day in my life when those people left in June of 2008. It was horrendous, and it's something that no one should be put through. None of those people who lost their jobs at that particular moment in time did anything to deserve it. They were victims of a confluence of events. Is there corporate mismanagement involved that led to some of them losing their jobs? Possibly. In what business isn't there, you know, those kinds of things? But there were also systemic, societal, macroeconomic things in play, which made that business unscalable, unsustainable at its existing size.
I think, and you know, to that point, you're talking about a confluence of events. Obviously, the publishing industry going up in flames, the bookselling industry going up in flames, and this corporate attitude inside the company of let's try all these wild things, all those coming together. However, specifically that last one, let's try all these things, mm-hmm. I think the fans, because it's so public and Stu's projects were so
grandiose
and public and out there, people immediately, they combine those two. They're like, Stu decides to make a movie, 30 people lose their job because he's mismanaging the company's funds. You know, this company would be okay if he had just focused on manga publishing. That's the chief criticism I hear. Mm-hmm. And I myself have posited that. Like, why is he spending money on this? Why doesn't he run his business? Why doesn't he run his manga publishing business? Mm-hmm. Is there truth to that? Is there accuracy to that?
Well, I don't know that that's a true or false kind of thing. I mean, first of all, the person that you need to address those questions to is Stu Levy.
Right.
I certainly have an opinion about that.
Well, that's what I'm sort of asking for.
Yeah. And no, I don't think that those things are related. I think that basically there were a lot of people, even internal at Tokyo Pop, who would occasionally raise their eyebrows at things that would happen and focuses that would, new initiatives that would come on board. But it was also part of what made Tokyo Pop Tokyo Pop. And it was also part of why people got up and came to work every day, is because it was an exciting, dynamic environment. And so, you know, you gotta kind of look at these things, whether that particular guy was an effective CEO can certainly be debated ad nauseum. This company doesn't really exist in its former form, so maybe he failed. Okay, that's fine. A lot of people do. A lot of people try different things. But while he was doing that, while he was stewarding that company, he was attempting to do what good CEOs do, which is look to the future, understand what's happening now, and how his company could be positioned to survive in the future. And he made some bets that didn't pay off. He was up against some time. It was never a particularly well-capitalized company. We typically ran it almost entirely on cash flow. There were never any significant rounds of investment in Tokyopop. And so, you know, eventually we just, you know, the cash kind of caught up with us. And there were a lot of decisions along the way that were good, others that were bad. But you don't just sit in a corner and try to eke out something that you know eventually is going to be threatened by all these technological and societal challenges. You swing for the fences.
Right.
You know? At least that's what we wanted to do.
Right.
Okay. And whether that's good or bad, you know, I'm not being contentious in terms of people having that attitude about Tokyopop, because I kind of love it. You know, I mean, I'm a guy who, one of the earliest things I ever did at UCI when I had a mailing list of 150,000 people is I actually hit reply all to someone responding to a question. This is back in like 1995 or something. And it was just an incendiary event, and half of my customer base wanted to lynch me. And that's just, you got to enjoy stuff like that, because in business, in life, in art, that's what makes things fun. And I'm not trying to justify incompetence. I'm not trying to say, oh my God, the worse you are at something, the more interesting it is. It's just that you have to embrace the ridiculousness of it at times, you know?
I just tell you, like, the headline coming out of this, the response is going to be, irresponsible thrill seekers destroy company.
Hey, you know what?
Not that that's true, but I tell you, that's how people are going to interpret that, man.
It's been my great pleasure to have served served anime and manga fandom in a variety of capacities for the last almost 20 years, and no interpretation possible of any of this would surprise me.
Okay.
So let's just jump right to it. Borders.
Mm-hmm.
Atom bomb or hydrogen bomb? Like, how it's difficult for someone who's not in the industry to really wrap their head around what that meant.
Well, I mean, I think either will kill you.
Right.
So I'm not really sure. It was a huge event.
Yeah.
They ended up owing us a significant amount of money at a time when we couldn't survive without that payment. And in fact, the timing of that particular event was so particularly awful and cynical, because they had stocked up for a holiday season before they declared bankruptcy. And so it'd have been different if it would have happened in June. But the fact that it happened in January, after our having pushed all this stuff into the market, was particularly devastating.
Is that why a number of the publisher creditors, you think, were not willing to work with them?
I think there were people, I'm not sure exactly what you mean by that, but there were people who, even before that period of time, were watching Borders very, very closely, as were we. You know, we were not taken entirely by surprise, but at the same time, it's like, what can you do?
Yeah, you're not going to sell to Borders?
Exactly. That could have been a decision that we could have made in, you know, early 2010 or late 2009. What if we just cut Borders off? Where would we be today? And that kind of takes you back to the whole, you know, three people in a cubbyhole in Wilshire. Maybe that could have survived.
I hate to ask you this, but could you just kind of take us through the chain of events, like what... Because that kind of spiraled for a while before finally exploding entirely.
The chain of events for what?
Well, realizing that you were just never going to get paid, that they finally filed Chapter 11 when you knew that was inevitable.
Well, we've been hearing off and on for a long time that was going to happen. And then there was a couple month period of time when it looked to be inevitable. And then they filed. And then basically, you know, at that point, we just kind of went into a series of discussions with HarperCollins about what did that actually mean? You know, what were the likely outcomes? There was going to be a creditors committee set up to evaluate, you know, the disposition of Borders assets and you know, what did it mean for a company like Tokyopop?
You build through HarperCollins.
I'm sorry?
You build through
yes.
HarperCollins?
Yeah, for that channel. We also of course, dealt with Diamond for the direct market.
Right.
But all of our non-direct market stuff went through HarperCollins. And so, yeah, we just, you know, sat down with Harper and figured out what it meant and what the likelihood of the chain of events was, what the timing was going to be. One of the challenges with the book industry, I think that one of your... I guess I saw this on Twitter. One of you asked some of your followers about, hey, what question should we ask Mike when, you know, during the...
We get to those later.
Yeah.
We'll get to them.
And one of them I remember was, well, couldn't they have just gotten smaller and survived? And one of the problems with them, it's really a math exercise, and it relates to this subject of returns, that it's very, very difficult. If you can pick a moment in time and say, okay, we're starting from scratch, we're starting from zero. We have, let's pretend we have no books in the market, and we're just publishing 5 or 10 or 15 copies. You put those out in the market. Some of them sell, some of them don't. We get small. We have one person. We can sustain that. Yeah, okay. The problem is you've got 10 years of history of hundreds of thousands of books out on the market that while you're still really small and putting out one or two or three books a month, all of these other books still come back.
Oh.
And so it doesn't work.
You can never get ahead of the returns.
You could never get ahead of the returns unless you have a huge hit, which kind of buoy you and sustain the onslaught of that tidal wave of returns.
But at the same time, if it were that easy.
Yeah, and that's one of the reasons why, you know, in 2009 and 2010, something like Hetalia helps, you know, even though it was only a couple volumes. Those are the things that basically you kind of, you know, there are three things in the publishing industry, three groups of books. One of them is returns, the books that are coming back to you. One of them are new. Second are the new releases, and the third are backlist. You know, existing titles that just continue to sell. People reorder. In an ideal scenario, as ridiculous as this sounds, your new releases will cancel out your returns, and you make your money on your backlist. Yeah. That's typically what, you know, a lot of, you know, kind of traditional publishers do. But when these two things are impacted and begin to shrink, and these two things, I know all of you out on the internet can't see what I'm referring to, but they're the new release and the backlist piles. When they become smaller and smaller and smaller because the market is shrinking and you don't put out as much product as you used to, this pile over here, the returns, isn't shrinking. Mm-hmm. It just keeps coming back. You know, and eventually over time, of course, there would be a steady state, you know, that would be achieved. But for the amount of time that a cash-strapped business that isn't being paid by its major customer has, it's a recipe for disaster.
Was there a D-Day?
In terms of...
Shuttering the company.
God, that's a... I don't know that I can even answer that. I mean, it was so... A lot of it you kind of try to block out.
Okay.
but at the same time, it was so intense for such a long period of... Well, what could we do this? Could we move this there? Could we try this? I certainly don't recall like an epiphany kind of light bulb moment where, you know, a group of us around a table just said, well, that's it. You know, it was always... There would be moments like that in different sort of sessions, and they had been occurring for a number of months before the end of May. But I don't recall one single event.
And that must have been, I mean, and I got to ask, it sounds like it was incredibly stressful for one or two too many years. Like, that seems like a really stressful environment. So you must have, did any part of you feel relief exhaling when it was finally over?
Certainly not from a professional point of view. From
right.
a professional point of view, it was an amazing experience that I certainly, and I think a lot of people who worked at Tokyo Pop would have wanted to have continued in some fashion. From a personal point of view, yeah, maybe. It's certainly possible. I know that. I don't think that it's. It would. I'd be honest to say that there wasn't a certain amount of. I don't know if relief is the right sense so much as what I'm doing now is very, very different from those last couple of years, and it's better. Okay. You know? I'll leave it at that. You know, I don't really want to come across as seeming relieved, because I think there were a lot of the company going down was a very, very bad thing for a lot of people. It was a very bad thing, obviously, for those remaining in Tokyopop's employ. It was a very bad thing for a lot of our business partners, because we weren't around anymore to help them. It was, and most importantly, it was a very bad thing for fans. You know, that there were still, even though the industry had changed dramatically and the scale of things was smaller, you know, no one who works in that business for as long as we had takes those kinds of things lightly, and that sucked, you know. Because we knew, you know, we knew what was going to happen in terms of the fan reaction. There was an overwhelming expression of sympathy and sorrow. There was also a lot of anger and a lot of "I told you so, goddamn, yeah. We saw this coming." And all of that is legitimate. You know, all of that is you know, those people who anyone who helped support the company along the way certainly earned the right to bitch and moan. Now, I do know that there are people who are professionally engaged in bitching and moaning and probably weren't really invested in the company ever being successful in the first place. And those, I'm not referring to that kind of thing. I'm referring to people who are fans of Loveless and just don't understand why they can't finish the series. Those are the people that I feel badly about.
Right. Now, it's been, what, 5-6 months since...
Yeah, my last day was the end of May. So, five months.
Yeah. Where are you at, like, psychologically with this experience? Like, is this something that you can look back on fondly yet, or is this...
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, to me, it was, as I've said, you know, on a number of occasions, it was an incredible ride. It exposed me to a group of people that... I can't express enough how amazing that experience was. It allowed me to work in a creative field when that is an extremely difficult way to make a living. I wouldn't even say that I'm consumed by regrets. You know, I think we gave it our best shot. You know, and I'm saddened by the fact that there are customers of ours, partners of ours, for whom our passing was a negative thing, because we relied on those people for our lifeblood for a number of years. And the fact that we aren't around anymore, that we couldn't figure out a way to survive and continue to be their partners and their sort of manga publisher of choice is a drag, you know. But I don't look at the experience overall as anything other than, you know, amazing.
No regrets, basically.
No, I mean, I've mentioned some regrets. I've mentioned some things that we could have done differently in the course of our discussion today. But, God, you know, I mean, how many mistakes do you make in a day? You know,
it doesn't outweigh the positive for you.
No, absolutely not. You know, and I don't think it will for fandom either. You know, I mean, I think Tokyopop, as incendiary a reputation as it has, as checkered a past as it has, that name resonates. That name means something for good as well as for evil. and I'm proud to have been a part of that. You know?
So in terms of evil, can we get your opinion on America's Greatest Otaku?
From what?
What how did you think? What did you think about that when you first saw it? When you first heard the pitch? When you saw the episode? What was how did you feel about it? What did you think? Good idea, bad idea? Did you think it was done well?
I think that there's a germ of an idea there that could have been. I mean, there are ridiculous shows on air. I mean, there's a phenomenon in reality programming where you focus in on niches that are far narrower than anime and manga, and by extracting from those experiences essential kind of human experiences, you produce entertainment that people who have known nothing about, you know, ice fishermen in Alaska or something, could ever hope to know. And so I think it had the potential to be something like that. But ultimately it wasn't. You know, it wasn't. Right. The execution was, you know, I think at the same time it was, you know, a first try.
Right.
And would it have, would, you know, if there had been a season 2, would that have been better? It absolutely would have. but it doesn't stand alone as something that people who weren't into the space would have much interest.
And tying that back into earlier about those projects seemingly taking away from the manga publishing mm-hmm. business, that project at that particular time when everybody sort of saw the writing on the wall for Tokyo Pop, I mean, so those two were totally disconnected in your head. Like, you didn't see that, oh, maybe we shouldn't be doing this right now. Like, no.
I mean, there, you can always say, circle the wagons and let's just do these four things that we know. At the end of the day, one of the things, part of the kind of, what do you call that thing that's written on your tombstone? Epitaph. You know, one of the things that could be written as part of Tokyo Pop's epitaph is that, I've totally lost my train of thought now that I was trying to think of that word. But I think that, you know, America's Greatest Otaku, the idea of projects being distractions, you're just trying to move the ball forward in new areas to allow your business to survive. And I know it, I totally understand why, oh, if they had only not done that, you know, it had to have involved some mind share, it had to involve some money. So if they had just taken that and put it here, it would have been different. But it was a judgment call that we made based on the sustainability of a business that was disappearing, you know? And I get that people can debate that, but I think that in general, we should have tried a number of the things that we tried. Maybe not all of them, but we took a shot.
You're attempting to diversify.
Yeah.
So maybe the epitaph would be, hey, at least we tried.
You know, I'll come back to the epitaph, because I'm pretty sure I had something pithy in mind.
You know, I always thought that any sort of documentary programming about the anime manga scene in general is just almost impossible to pull off, because it's just such a never-ending barrage of in-jokes with gobbledygook-sounding names to Americans. And you end up spending all your time explaining the in-jokes rather than building anything.
Yeah, I think if you focus on that, you certainly would. But at the end of the day, you know, all of those kids are people, and they all have backstories, and they all come from somewhere. They all have, you know, what's their experience like at home and with their family? What's their experience like at school? Are they nerds? Are they picked on? Are they bullied? Is this a, you know, what role does this cosplay? What role does their obsession with, you know, fan sub VHS tapes back in the 90s, what does that play in their lives as human beings? That's where the story is.
At some point, Tokyo Pop got representation at an agency and was approaching Hollywood studios to, were you representing manga, licensed manga properties? Were you representing your OEL stuff?
Both.
Mm-hmm. What was the farthest you managed to get with any of those endeavors?
Well, there's still a number of things that are in development now. Whether they're in the proverbial development hell and will never see the light of day is certainly a possibility. But there probably are three or four projects, this is on the OEL side, mm-hmm. that could one day see the light of day. In terms of actually getting produced, the one thing that has been produced so far is the Priest movie.
Which you were actually involved in.
Correct. We were executive producers on that project.
Yes, Stu introduced it at San Diego Comic-Con.
Oh, right. obviously, the film wasn't a huge success. Mm-hmm. How did that work for you guys in terms of building brand equity in Hollywood? And obviously, just having a project you're involved with get released is huge. Mm-hmm. So was it successful for you ultimately, do you think?
I think so. I think it helped. You know, obviously, it wasn't successful in terms of helping keep the manga publishing business afloat. It right. wasn't that successful. It's not like we were suddenly selling 50,000 copies of all 16 volumes of Priest. But at the same time, yeah, anything like that adds some legitimacy. And Hollywood is all about, you know, the perception that you have something that people want, you know. And if you don't have that perception, there's very little you can do to change it. And if you do, you know, every word that comes out of your mouth is hallowed and sacred.
Gotta love this town.
Now that we've gone through all of that, we have... Some questions for you from fans on Twitter, from Chuo Dori. If offered, would you return to what looks like the new Tokyo Pop? And if so, on what terms?
I don't think I can answer that because I'm not sure I understand exactly what the new Tokyo Pop is.
Okay, so but you've seen what's happening in the news, and they're talking about coming back on Facebook, and they opened that Twitter account where they're talking about getting back into publishing. I mean, how are you paying close attention to that?
Not
or is
really.
You've moved on, in other words.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So the answer is no.
Although it isn't a no in the sense of, you know, that I don't wish that enterprise well.
Oh, okay. Right, of course.
But it's just, yeah, it's not, it wouldn't be, I can't imagine that there would be a role for me that would interest me in that endeavor.
All right. Do you feel like you should have done more about piracy earlier on? Was there something you could have done more about piracy early on?
No, I don't know. Maybe.
Did you guys ever really see that as a huge threat?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
It was a huge threat. We could have, you know, we tried to bring it to the attention. It's basically, a lot of it is about, you know, getting the Japanese interested and involved. And over the past couple of years, they have become. But could we have done that earlier? You know, we tried. But I think it's kind of a, is it really something that our partners wanted to rock the boat on or really understood the full extent of? I also kind of personally believe that, you know, it's kind of like putting a genie back in a bottle. You know, how do you really, I mean, the music industry certainly has never recovered from that. And, you know, how do you unlearn the ability to build a nuclear weapon? You know, I mean, the fact is, information, once it's digitized, wants to be free, and it's the major challenge of entertainment in the 21st century is how to continue to do that and you know, make a business out of it. So I'm not really sure, you know, exactly what we could have done differently. You know, whether we should have tried, sure. Yeah.
Okay. All right. Deb Aoki asks, for years, former Tokyo Pop creators have been asking for the rights back to their comics. Why is Tokyo Pop balking at this?
Well, again, I'm not really sure what the current... Tokyo Pop still continues to exist
On paper.
Well, yeah, and as a corporation that has intellectual property, that intellectual property is, I believe that the plan is to continue to attempt to monetize it in various ways, you know, online, film, TV, video games, and so at what point does it make sense for Stu to consider, you know, focusing on certain things and letting other things go? You know, I'm sure that's a process that he's going through now. You know, trying to determine what to do.
Well, I think the emotion behind this question is that those properties belong to their creators, and now that Tokyo Pop is, so to speak, dead, although you just refuted that, that you should just give them back their properties and let them try to monetize it themselves and let them create more of it and, you know, not create a copyright issue. That's the emotion, I think, behind this.
Yeah, I'm not really sure that most...
Somehow it's unfair.
Yeah, I'm not... I get that at one level, but most of what you said isn't factually true.
Okay.
The properties are co-owned by the creators and the company. The company continues to exist. It doesn't publish manga in the form that it did before. And so the company that is a partner in that property is an entity that is continuing to recoup its significant investments in those properties originally, which sometimes run into the six figures. And so is it a responsible thing for the remaining, you know, part of that company, which is essentially Stu, to just willy-nilly hand those back without attempting to recoup some amount of shareholder value? I'm not really sure. You know, I mean, it's a more complicated discussion than just... Again, this gets back to what everybody signed up for.
Yeah.
And everybody, I think, was very, very clear. Now, you can certainly make the point that Tokyo Pop is not an active publisher at the moment. So if we were sitting on material that had been concluded and somehow not paid for or not published in any form, that would be an interesting situation to adjudicate. But once, when you're in a situation where we've entered into this agreement to produce this material, to fund the production of this material, and part of what we get for that in return is the ability to try to make something of it.
Mm-hmm.
Those conditions still pertain.
Yeah, it's not over yet, basically.
Right.
So, from a business sense, which is where you're coming from, and these people are coming from an emotional sense, and business side of it is, it doesn't make sense for us to just give Becky Cloonan back her comic book for warm fuzzies. Like, that just doesn't make sense business-wise.
Well, I mean, I completely understand this argument. I mean, since the day we got into the OEL business, there has been carping about the Tokyo Pop deal, you know, or the Tokyo Pop co-ownership of properties. You know, the page rate that Tokyo Pop pays for the production of these things. It's endemic to, and it's not just us. It's any publisher involved in the creation of IP. So I totally get the question. I totally understand it. I just think that I'm not in a position to do anything about it.
Right.
You know?
Right.
So all I can really do is say, well, the facts are there are these contracts in place. Is it a screw in certain cases? Yeah, probably is. It's probably an unfortunate situation.
Right. Okay. We've talked about this already, but I guess briefly, a lot of people saw it as abrupt, but can you shed light on why Tokyopop pulled the plug rather than just scale back, especially now considering they're talking about already coming back after only 5 months?
Yeah, well, the especially now part I can't comment on because I have no idea what that might be.
Okay.
What I would say is about the first part of the question is simply because of the mathematics involved in the book business, it didn't make sense. It wasn't possible.
Right. Also from Deb, could you share your proudest moment or achievement at Tokyopop?
I guess two things. I think that we were able to work. It was really, really, really exciting working on the OEL program. It was very, very exciting giving a group of people artistic exposure to an audience that they otherwise would not have had because of our distribution reach at the time. That was really. It was really a lot of fun because of what it meant for them, because of what it meant for our editors working on the projects, because of what it meant for all the production people. That was fun. The other thing, and this gets back to Kino Notabi, I personally feel that this is both a regret and a proud moment. I am heartbroken by the fact that we were never able to bring Kino Notabi to fruition in the way that it deserved. It is probably my favorite Tokyopop property of all time. We published a single volume of the novel. As you know, there are 6 or 7 novels and a couple of art books. In what I, to this day, believe was an exquisite adaptation of the Japanese original. And because it was not viewed in that light by the original creator, even after I personally flew to Japan and met with him and attempted to explain why the decisions we made were the right ones artistically and commercially, we had to defer to his wishes and not continue that series because I think the book we did was amazing. I regret not being able to finish that and bring the rest of them to the U.S. market.
The one that did get released, did that sell?
Yes. Yeah, did very well.
The books, the light novels in general, was that a successful line for you?
You know, it was hit and miss. 12 Kingdoms was very successful. And, you know, some of the light novels that were associated with popular licenses did well, just kind of by association. Dot Hack, a lot of those light novels did very well. But in general, I think they sold at a lower level than the manga.
I imagine translating those is very expensive.
Oh, it is. It's not quite as expensive as OEL, where you're paying for art as well, but it's significantly more expensive than a licensed manga.
Did all of the rights revert back, or are there still some that you just kind of have to wait out the clock on?
In terms of the license stuff?
Yeah.
I'm honestly not sure because it's been, you know, almost 6 months now. I think you guys would probably know this better than I, but aren't there already things that are starting to be brought out by...
Yeah.
Like, I think Yen brought out...
Alice, the Country of Hearts is already coming out,
And so, I think these things are just going to, you know, revert over time.
Okay. Sewing Rose 11 asks, why did you change the logo on the book spine? First, the fish was small and black and white, and then it became a big red bulge.
Well, she's not even referring to the last change in the logo. She's referring to a change in the logo like 4 years ago.
Right.
Interesting. You go through different feelings about branding. You know, try different approaches. The change that she's talking about, unless I'm misunderstanding her question, was relatively minor. It was kind of a big deal in fandom because if we did it in mid series and so lined up 10 volumes,
four
were slightly, you know, different.
My spines, yeah.
And so, you know, the hallowed spines were tampered with. There was a significant new branding as recently as in the last year or so that really changed the look and feel of Tokyopop Books and kind of was based on a lot of feedback we've gotten from retail. That was only being instituted on new titles. And so maybe it was something that this person hadn't really noticed yet.
All right. How close to being completed was Italia Volume 3 when you shut down?
From a production point of view? Well,
yeah.
Obviously it's done because it's done in Japan.
Yeah.
I think from a production point of view, we were pretty much ready to go.
Were there books in boxes?
Oh, no. No, I'm talking about...
You were ready to have it printed.
I'm talking about the pre-production work.
Okay. Okay, Vince A. just asks very simply, what was it like working for Stu?
Well, all of those things that I said before, you know, exciting, infuriating.
A little crazy.
Crazy. He challenges you in a number of ways to do some of your best work. He also can set up certain kinds of roadblocks that you find yourself spending a lot of time working around. Mm. But that's what a boss is.
Right.
And overall, you know, if you can't kind of... I think he's a very easy guy to criticize from the outside for very, you know, what I understand to be legitimate reasons. But he's also a guy who is inspiring in kind of a unique way. You know, he's intellectually engaging. He's demanding. He really cares about quality. And those are all really good attributes to have in someone who's attempting to set the tenor for an organization.
All right. Ed Sizemore asks, did the Disney titles make money for you?
Yep.
Okay.
Lots and lots of money.
And he this is a little rough, but he says, comic history is littered with the corpses of companies that expanded too fast. Why did Tokyopop seem to think it was immune from suffering the same fate? Was no one advising caution?
Absolutely no one was. We felt like we were Ed's absolutely 100% right. Spot on, Ed. Good job.
You lit the car on fire and sent it towards the cliff.
I don't think that's a sophisticated enough question from a business point of view to warrant a serious response.
I'm sure Ed will love that answer. Let's see here. Astro CGI, were you planning on an online presence and online distribution before you shut down? I guess he's talking about like a J-Manga type of thing where you're going to digitally distribute.
Oh, sure,
distribute
absolutely.
So that was in the plans. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Was there one license you wanted the most that escaped your grasp that you can actually talk about? One that sticks out that, like, man, I wish we had that, besides Naruto?
Wow.
Pokemon.
You know, there was, and I'm ashamed to admit I'm going to forget the name of this thing. Back when we got Fruits Basket, which I believe was like 2003, is when we got the license, we did a series of online polls at Tokyopop.com, and there was a shoujo title that Viz eventually got that was consistently at the top of all of our rankings of, what would you like to see Tokyopop license? But no, I think you know, you get what you can. I mean, it was painful in the transition, in the Kodansha transition to Del Rey, to miss out on things like that we would ordinarily have gotten. So those were not happy days.
All right. What manga publications do you think are doing things right now in terms of digital and in print?
You know, again, it's... I don't really consider myself fully qualified to answer that because of, you know, I haven't been really paying close attention for the past.
I can imagine. Yeah.
I think that my understanding is that Viz is moving very, very close to a kind of day-and-date approach on the digital side, and that's always been sort of the holy grail in the Japan-U.S. kind of nexus. And so if that's true, and if that's something that they can execute, that seems like a very exciting kind of development. I'm not sure that may have been actually the first time I ever said something about NICE. Something nice about Viz.
Well, now you can do those sorts of things.
Yeah, absolutely. Good job, Viz.
Also asks, why did you opt not to print completed OEL graphic novels like Shutterbox 5, King City 2, and other finished work? I assume sales, but...
Yeah, I mean, first of all, each one of those is a very different case. King City 2 eventually saw the light of day through an alliance with Image, which I was very proud to have been a part of, because Brandon's book was one of those things that I cared a lot about, and which wasn't... His content and his style wasn't, you know, probably remarkably well served by a publisher who at the end of the day was kind of... Oh, I remember the... I don't want to go back to that at this point.
It's going to tease everyone.
So it was fun. It was fun. It was fun to see the material that would have been King City 2 come out in oversized floppy format through Image. Other things that didn't come out that weren't continued were purely, you know, God, we can't spend another $30,000 on this book, you know, when it sells 500 copies.
All right. What was behind the decision to turn the website into a social media site? And why did the books become less prominent in that site design?
There's so many different iterations of TokyoBok.com. I became increasingly less involved with it over the years. I presume this person is probably talking about the final iteration of the TokyoBok website. And I think a number of people internally were frustrated by the same kinds of things. That at the end of the day, it was another example of an attempt to broaden the appeal of the site by not only providing information, but also providing a forum, a space. But that's not ultimately what people wanted from TokyoPop, you know. In the final analysis, in spite of everything else that we did, some of which was good and some of which didn't work so well, what really 99% of our customers wanted from us was Japanese licensed manga. And I think that's something that we all, I'm certainly not afraid to admit that, to understand that. And it's just the way it is, you know. And if we had made decisions along the way which were congruent with that desire on the majority of our fan base, then yeah, certain things might have been easier. My personal opinion, for the reasons I indicated earlier, is that that wasn't a sustainable path for the company, but I certainly understand that being the reason for a lot of the criticism.
Okay. All right, just two left. All About Manga asks, why didn't anybody inform TokyoPop's freelancers before the news of the company's closure hit the internet?
I'm not sure how to respond to that.
Okay.
I think the way that the closure... trying to remember how the closure was actually communicated. I believe that it was a press release that was picked up by all the normal, you know, all the usual suspects.
Right.
Now, had we in advance of that reached out to every single or even a significant number of freelancers? Probably not. You know, it probably was just a function of, you know, there were a very small number of us at the end of the day, and it was a very chaotic time.
All right. And finally, Land of Obscusion asks, BTX Volume 16 had a premium price of $12.99 when finally released. Was this going to be the plan for hiatus or low-selling series?
I think there were a group of titles in the last... It wasn't just BTX. It was, you know, for the last couple of years, there were a group of titles that we wanted to try to keep in print. And the theory was that, hey, you know, if only 500, 750, 1,250 people are really going to buy this, can we somehow recoup our production costs, at least, by charging a premium price for those books, under the theory that people who really, really want them would would pay them out of a sense of supporting the title continuing, because at the $9.99 price they no longer made sense, and so the alternative was to kill them.
Okay, well, that about wraps it up. Can't thank you enough for inviting us to your lovely home and talking to us about all this stuff. I know it probably is still recent enough to be a little tough, and I really appreciate your candor and how candid you were with us.
Well, it was my pleasure. Since about 1994, it's been an additional pleasure for me to have interacted with a lot of people in the anime and manga community, and it's been a fantastic ride, and I wouldn't have missed a day of it.
Okay, that's our show. Thanks to Mike for coming on. The theme song is Bucharest. It's by the band The New Division. You can check them out at thenewdivision.net. Don't forget, subscribe to us on iTunes, and while you're there, leave us a little rating or review. We'd appreciate it. And hey, see you all next week.